Interview with Mal Elder. It's still August 1st, 2005. So did the freeway, or I should say the lack of a freeway when you first got here, did that present any problems to you as a sign builder for getting things out of the area? For example, I've driven parts of that road between here and Pendleton, and it only takes me 40 minutes to get from here to Pendleton, but I don't think it took just that long then.
Well, to give you an idea, when we first moved here, there was no freeway down to Columbia. It was an 8-hour trip from here to Portland,
Yeah. Which
is now 4 to 4.5 hours.
Now, from the maps that I've seen, it wasn't a straight shot either. Didn't you end up going through every town and village?
Absolutely.
Even the Celilo Tepe village on your way across on the state.
Uh-huh. And so consequently, you didn't expect the service that you get nowadays. Just hope that everything went fine and you'd get it within a couple of days if you ordered out of Portland material. But at that time, I wasn't working out of town like we did later on. Mm-hmm. Most of our work was around Union County or maybe up to Enterprise. We did a lot of work up at Enterprise. There's still some of our work up there.
In the beginning here?
Yeah.
What work did you do in Enterprise? Who did you build signs for there?
I can't remember the name of the... It's a car wash, laundry, I believe. The electric signs of the Evanison. And one of the nice jobs we did was we didn't build the signs, but we installed them. It was at Dodge Chrysler sign for Milligan Motors up there, not Milligan, Courtney Motors up in Enterprise. And, Circle R Cafe did a lot of work for them, which is no longer, and worked on like the Stockman sign, Enterprise Hotel, we did a lot of work for them. And
now, how did people find out about you? If you did work clear over to Boise and up into Walla Walla and Dayton and some of these outer regions of the area, was that done by referral, or just how did they find out about
you? Oh, there's a number of ways. A lot of it was personal contact. And
Chevron
is a big business.
Well, yeah, that got us out around quite a bit, but that wasn't early on. Early on, it was, like I say, Union, Walla Walla, Baker County. We used to do quite a lot of work in Baker early times. But I made a lot of friends with businessmen. Just stopped to see them and visit a little bit. And then playing golf, you'd meet a lot of them. And just one thing led to another, you know.
What I think we these days call networking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, did a little advertising, always had an ad in the classified phone book. Once in a while in the newspaper.
And how about radio?
Occasionally, yeah. And we did. Matter of fact, we built KLBM's first sign for them. They first set up.
And we're finishing up the interview today with Mel Elder. The date is August 11, 2005. We took a break because of the Union County Fair and other involvement last week. Let's go back to a little bit more, finish up some of the local stuff that we've talked about in your sign work here. And I think we had talked just a little bit about the theaters downtown, the State, the Liberty, and the Granada Theater. Now, were all three of those theaters operating when you came to La Grande?
Yes, they were. Uh-huh. Yes.
Had you ever attended did you go to the theater there?
Oh, yeah. I can't remember any particular shows that we went to see. I remember when the Liberty Theater came out with the 3D movies, they'd issue you special glasses when you went in.
What did you think about that?
Well, it was sure a lot different than anything we'd ever experienced before.
Now, did you, when you got these 3D glasses, did you use those for other shows?
Yeah, as I remember, we could retain them and reuse them.
Did any of these theaters do any live performances? I know that they had in some of their earlier days before you came to town, other interviews. But were they doing that when you were here?
No, I don't remember any live performance.
Okay. What kind of sign work did you do for any of these theaters?
Oh, early on, it was mostly neon repair work.
So you didn't put up signs, you serviced them.
Yeah, the signs were already there when I came down, the marquees. That was mainly it, just maintenance on the existing marquees.
How about, we talked a little bit, tell us the story of converting, was it the State Theater that got converted to the Trocadero?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, we took all the lettering off of it and put the new lettering up for Trocadero. And I remember one thing in particular was State requirement of not being able to see the word cocktails more than once on the front of a place of business.
And that was a law? Was that a law at the time?
Yeah, it was written into their liquor laws. Without even considering it, we put cocktails on both sides of the V-shaped marquee.
This V-shaped marquee protruded from the side of the building out onto the street.
I never thought about if you could stand right straight across from the theater or the marquee, you could see cocktails on both sides.
So but technically,
I'm
it was up
sure
there more than once.
But they caught it.
Did they get fined or in trouble for that?
No, they didn't get fined. They just had to eliminate it on one side.
So they kept the sign, but they took cocktails off of one side.
It was just small lettering.
Now, did that change later?
I think it has, yeah.
You never were called back to put it back up later, second one?
No, not that I remember of, no.
Let's move on to talking a little bit about, there used to be an event in this area for well over a decade called the Native American Arts Festival, and you had some involvement in that. What did you have to do with that event?
My wife, she helped arrange for housing for different ones that were coming for it, and also helped with providing food. And we had, I think it was four girls here from Shiprock, New Mexico, stayed with us for two or three days.
Did they come back year after year, or was
no,
this a one-year event?
No, it was only one time.
I see.
And when it came time to leave, they didn't want to go. They really enjoyed it, being here.
Did you do that more than that one year?
I don't recall of it more than one year.
Did you know any of the Native artisans or people who were involved in sponsoring or operating that event?
At the time, it seemed like we knew mostly just by knowing who they were. I don't know that we got really acquainted with any of them.
Do you know what, do you have any idea why that event kind of dissolved?
Oh, I think it was lack of interest.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think even Native Americans sort of started losing interest.
Did this event ever include a powwow as well as the festival, or did they just stick to sort of an arts and Native crafts type of...
I think they had dances.
Uh-huh.
If I remember right.
Ceremonial dancing.
I think they did some ceremonial dancing,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Gladys Price was the head of it here locally.
Head of the festival?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was the one that really got behind it and promoted it.
Was she a Native American?
No. Uh-huh. No, she was not.
I see. Let's move on and talk about your church. You are affiliated with which church again in town here?
It's First Christian Church, Disciples of Christ.
Now, I think you told me that you were a member of this church. Were you a member of this church all your life?
No, I was born and raised in a Brethren church. And then when my wife and I became married, she had belonged to the Christian church, so I joined the Christian church.
And you did this before you came to Oregon?
Or was that after you got here? No, not really. No, I think Tillamook is when I first actually became a member of the First Christian Church. However, that was an independent church, where here in La Grande is Disciples of Christ.
That's the bigger organization that
it is. Yeah, they're not really affiliated, but they're similar.
I see. Now, that's the one you and I talked about, that there was a news article recently about the church leaders had elected a female leader of the church.
Yeah, they had assembly in the National Assembly in Portland just 2 weeks ago. And yes, there was a lady elected as the president of the assemblies.
I think we also read that women have actually commonly held leadership positions within the church.
Oh, yeah,
all through its history.
We have a number of elders in the church now that are women,
mm-hmm.
And as deaconess also.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, my wife and I both have served as elders, and I think both of us have been deacons too. I was for years.
What are the responsibilities of elders in the church?
Well, in a way, their leadership and almost, you might consider them an assistant to the pastor himself, because a lot of times any illness in the church, they do visitations, and they've been known to anoint with oil people that are real seriously ill, and administer the covenants. I'm a short to remember the term.
That's okay.
They take the
That's okay. We can come back to it if you you remember later. How do you get a? Is it an appointment to become an elder? How do people assume those positions?
Well, every year, the deacons and the elders both have a certain amount of them that go off duty. They have a year of rest, you might call it. And so the nominating committee, who's appointed by the church board, they get candidates for either elders or deacons, get their permission, and then the congregation votes whether they are accepted or not.
Do they do that publicly or by secret ballot?
Oh, it's by secret ballot, yes. What I was trying to tell you a little bit ago is that the elders take communion to shut-ins. That's one of them.
Oh, one of their other duties?
Yeah, that's one of the things they do.
Mm-hmm. So, how about the deacon then? What are the responsibilities of a deacon or a deaconess?
Well, of course, they are the ones who serve communion. And they have other duties, such as, if there's work parties in the church, to clean up the area or paint up the church. Usually depend on deacons to volunteer to do a lot of that work.
Would you categorize this as perhaps like a volunteer workforce, or?
Well, yeah,
uh-huh.
It would be, yeah.
Uh-huh. Any other duties besides that?
I'm sure that there's some that I'm overlooking. If I had my outline, I could give you a direct answer on that.
That's okay. And you've served in both capacities, you and your wife?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Are you currently serving in
any of
those?
Not right now. We're both on.
Are you on your year break?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now. Let's talk a little bit about the First Christian Church here. You've told me that was built in the early 50s, so
yes.
That church was built after you arrived in La Grande?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Did you help with that?
I didn't really put in much time, as much as I should have probably. I was so busy trying to make a go of my business that I didn't put in the time that I should have.
One other thing, where is this church in La Grande?
It's on Penn. I can't tell you the actual number, but it's on Penn.
Is this the church that's next to the United Methodist Church?
Back to back.
Back to back. It's a brick building.
Yeah.
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 Tell me about the story of getting the wooden arches for that church.
Oh yeah, that was quite a project. Harvey Elmer, who was one of the elders in the church for years, had a sawmill of his own, and he volunteered to cut the timber, have it milled or sawed. He sawed it and then had it milled, planed and dried, I guess. Then he laminated these huge arches.
How many were there?
I think it's four arches. And I can't tell you what the height on them is, but
they were big.
45 feet long, at least.
Uh-huh.
And he laminated them. In order to get the right arc on him, he had, I never did see his setup on it, but he had to get these in an arc bent, glued, held there until they set up, you know. And it was certainly quite a project.
Where was his sawmill located?
It was out in, it would be east of Alisal, I guess it's called that. It'd be northeast of LeGrand.
Do you remember what the
valley?
Do you remember the name of the mill?
Oh, it was his own personal, Harvey Elmer. His own personal mill.
I see.
And I'm not sure who he had plane the lumber, but I'm sure he must have brought it at Poison Cascade or somebody to the planing of it.
So to get these, this might not be in your expertise field, but we're talking about get them in the arch shape. Does that mean they would have had to do some sort of soaking process in order to bend, or were they cut
yeah,
that way?
Yeah, there had to be some bending on it, but I guess I've studied them, and really the main way of getting the right arch would be using in the area where they made the bend, they used more thicknesses, more laminations, and as you went out, it thinned down. So right at the fulcrum or the point where they went off and up at an angle rather than straight up, which is done by just more laminations.
Mm-hmm. How about getting these to the church? Tell us about that.
Well, the story is that they were too wide, and that arc that they formed would be way too wide to be legal to haul on a road. And just so happened at the time that the sergeant at the state police was a member of our church, and they consulted him about bringing them in. He said, well...
Who was that?
His name was Dave Brisendine.
Okay.
And he said, well, you bring them in, keep on the county roads as much as possible, and I'll see to it that there's no patrolman out in that area when you bring them in, so that you can get by ring in that way.
Were you around when they got those arches into town? Did you see any of
them? No, I didn't. Uh-huh. I didn't help with that. No.
When we talked about this, so were these arches already joined together? So
they were
complete, or were they in halves?
They were in halves.
I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I might preface this too with when our church was built, the fellowship hall and classrooms were completed first. And we held church up in the fellowship hall. Well, they have small wooden beams the same as in the worship area that he had made. They were on a lot smaller scale.
He had done those for the for that other hall?
Yeah, mm-hmm. For the fellowship hall.
It's my understanding this is the golden anniversary of the First Christian Church this year.
Yes.
50 years?
For the building itself, the completed building.
And you've been a member of this congregation ever since you came to town then?
Yes.
So you've spent 50 years involved with this church.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. And longer.
Right.
Because I think we probably were in the old church for a year or so. Uh-huh.
Tell me about this former minister, Gene Robinson, who you said he was here in the 60s.
Yeah. He was the type of person that everybody, if they didn't have a minister, they'd call on him to fill the bill. Everybody thought he was the greatest.
You mean other churches of Christian or other churches?
Other people that maybe didn't have a church home.
Oh, I see.
They always called on him, or if they needed somebody to give an indication at a meeting, Gene Robinson was the guy. They always called on him. Very effective leader. And at that time, I think most churches had probably more active members than they do today. But we had probably almost three times as many active members then as we do now. Kind of like any other organization, it seems like the younger people, they don't go for organizations. They just live a different life.
So what kinds of things did this minister Robinson, you said he gave invocations, was he a public speaker?
Oh, I think, yeah, I guess you'd say so in certain occasions. I did a lot of funerals, a lot of weddings, and if need be, yes, he did. He was a very good speaker.
What happened to him?
He went on to a ministry, I think it was up in Montana, I believe, and was there for some time, and eventually he went to Denver, and he held a pulpit job in at least one, I think two churches in the Denver area. Then he passed on several years ago.
He was here in the 1960s, so he wasn't the first minister when you came to town then.
Yes, he was.
Is that right?
Yeah, he was. We came in 49. And, he was a minister then.
So he was
on it through into the 60s.
So he was here quite a while then.
Quite a while, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd have to look at the history in order to be able to tell you the year that he left. But okay.
Well, that brings up a good question then. So is there a well-documented history of this First Christian Church here?
Oh, yes, there is.
Is there?
Yes. Dorothy Fleischman, her and her husband George lived up the canyon toward Morgan Lake, and she's our church historian right now, and she's been doing a lot of work on it. In fact, the 50th anniversary, she did the whole put together the history of the church.
Like retrospective?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that document available to the public?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see. Let's talk about another one of your, one of the other social programs that you were involved in here, and that was the JCs. You belong to the JCs.
Yes.
What's the goal or the purpose of the JC organization?
JCs is short for Junior Chamber of Commerce. And their goal was to do a lot of civic work. Several of the things that I recall was Riverside Park had a lot of dense brush around the edges, and we'd go out there on weekends and work all day long cleaning that brush out.
I see.
And another project I remember is the Little League ball fields that we use today, the original ones. We helped put in the water system, the sprinkling system for them.
Are those fields the ones that are over there by Pioneer Park?
Yes, they are.
Uh-huh. Did you hold office with the JCs?
No, I think I was vice president one time, but I was appointed chairman of the racetrack project.
Yes, I want to talk about that. How did that come? Tell us how that came to be, first of all.
Well, our president, who was M. Smock, Emerson Smock at the time, he was from Boise, and he'd been in the JCs down there, and he knew of one JC club that had sponsored a stock car racetrack. So it seemed like the membership thought that was a pretty good idea, and he pointed his finger at me to be chairman. And
we're finishing the interview with Mel Elder. It is August 11th, 2005, and we're talking about the little business venture, not so little it sounds like, with the JCs for a stock car race. And you were saying that this was being undertaken to raise money?
Yeah, it was a money-raising project.
Mm-hmm.
And
you got appointed to be the chairman of the committee.
Yes, I was.
And so...
So the first thing that happened, we had a wrecking, let's see, it was at the time. I'll have to think a minute. Lynn's Villa was a night spot out southeast of town, out on the Highway to Union.
A night spot?
Yeah.
Nightclub?
Nightclub and dinner club. And they had extra space out there, extra room. So the owner there volunteered to let us use the necessary amount of property to develop this racetrack. And I think probably he had ulterior motives too, that it would help his business. Well, the first thing that needed to be done is to recruit equipment, earth moving equipment. So I started calling on various owners of bulldozers, and actually, the Soil Conservation District loaned us an earth mover, and I think the grader was, no, the grader was privately owned. So I got at least those three pieces of equipment and operators, and we laid it out and started work on it. I actually didn't even have a blueprint, just let's do it.
Just made it up as you went along?
Our goal was to have a quarter mile track, which it turned out to be. So we got the supers, built the supers on each end.
What are those?
Bank curves around the end,
mm-hmm.
on either end. And then the straightaway would be straight. And then we got thinking, well, it's going to be awful dusty, so we got to have water. So we got a party with the backhoe and dug a well right out in the middle of the track in the infield, and We had a Joe Evers, which is the father of Jim Evers, who still lives here. He had a water wagon, and we'd pump water into it. He had a sprinkler on the back of the tank there, and he'd drive around the track and water it.
So the track was never paved, it was just graded dirt.
Just graded dirt uh-huh. track.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, it was a bad type of soil. It was sort of a clay. So when we watered, if we watered it too heavy, the car would spin out. You get some terrible messes. But in the building of it, one other thing we had to have was packer, you know, to pack the soil. And it was sheep foot packers. And then we got to thinking, well, we got to keep those cars on the track. So we got railroad ties, sunk them in the ground for posts. And we went out in the woods and logged logs to put a railing around it.
Around the inside and outside of the track?
Around the outside of the track, keep the cars running off into the crowd. And that was all done by hand. That was quite an undertaking.
Was this
just fastening those logs to the... The post was quite a job, too. But we finally got it all organized and started the races.
Was this building done within one season then, or one summer, or when did you...
I think, yeah, if I remember right, we did it mostly, started real early, and by the end of summer we were ready to have a few races.
So tell us about that. How did that work?
Well, we had a group of racing enthusiasts that developed their own cars for racing. And I guess they went to the junkyards and got cars and overhauled them and got them running. And we had several that were outstanding. That everybody was after him to beat him. His name was Jim Sinelli. He had a machine shop here in the Grand, and he had by far the fastest car on the track.
So this was all local involvement then?
And yeah, 90%, yeah. I think there was a few that did come in from like Baker and around, but mostly local racers.
Now, where was that man's machine shop? That
it was in the alley. Let's see, it's been behind what now is Clayton's Auto Parts.
Was there an entry fee? How did?
Oh yeah, they had an entry fee for each race, and. The JCs handled the money and doled it out according to the race they win or placed in. I think they usually paid three places. And the town really supported the race day. Excuse me, race day would come along and people would flock out there. My wife, another one or two of the JCs would take the tickets. We got an old crate that they shipped caskets in.
A wooden one?
Yeah, stood it up on end and had a little shelf in it. The girls would get in there, and that was a ticket booth. They'd take tickets or sell tickets at the entry there. one of the memories we have is that a windstorm came up and blew that darn thing over, and the money just sprayed out over the sagebrush. There was quite a bit out in that area. I spent about half the race time picking up money out there in the sagebrush.
Was somebody manning the booth at the time?
I don't remember why. Just how it happened. I'm probably wrong about it blowing the booth over. It blew the cash box, I guess. That was probably the way it happened.
Uh-huh. But it was a casket crate that was your ticket booth.
Yeah.
So where did people sit when they came out for the races? Did you have bleachers?
We borrowed bleachers from the city park department. They were good enough to loan them to us. And by hook or crook, we got them loaded on trailer and haul them out there. And it was a real job getting them set up and moved. But as I remember, we kept them out there all summer. Then got them back in the fall, probably at fair time.
So this was a summer project?
It was all done in warm weather. I don't know, it ran into the fall pretty far, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What was the object then? Was this racetrack for speed? Is that how they won the prizes?
Oh yeah, the best time.
Uh-huh.
They had the special races too, what they called the powder puff derby.
And what was that?
The gals would race. Most of them were wives of guys that were racing. Then they had a race one time of us guys that did the SJC, the ones that were operating the track.
Did you race?
Scared me half dead to get that thing over 20 miles an hour.
What car did you race?
I think it was an old Plymouth Coupe, I believe it was.
Where'd you get it?
It was a friend that had ran it out there.
Uh-huh. Did you win?
No. I was too chicken.
Uh-huh.
But it was fun.
Did
the girls would get out there and really get with it. Mm-hmm. They'd go almost fast, the guys. There was occasions that they had pileups that see cars doing end over end up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
One of the cars ended up on the top of that railing on one end.
Huh. Was there any liability involved for doing this?
You know, there was a chance for a lot of liability, but we just figured, well, we're a non-profit organization. We don't have no assets. So we just went without any insurance. So I wonder if somebody wasn't killed. I remember one time a wheel came off the car when he was going full tilt. That wheel ran the full length of that track, jumped over the fence on the end, went out to the parking area. It never hit a thing. It could just as well hit a person or a car or most anything, but it didn't do any damage.
So no crowd injuries then during that time?
No, we didn't have any.
So did you make expenses and have a profit with that? Did it turn out to be profitable?
We had more money in the treasury than the JC's ever had. But it added up to about 10 cents an hour, the amount of time I put in. I was out there in the summertime. I'd be out there every night, third of dark, after work.
Doing what?
Working on the track.
Mm.
And of course, we all had to be there on race day.
Was race day on the weekends? Was it just one day?
On
the
weekends?
Sundays?
No.
Mm. And the community liked it, huh?
Oh yeah, they went popular. For it in a big way. Every race, was, the bleachers were full.
What became of that track?
After 2 years, after two summers operating it, we became just too tired of working there. And we turned it over to the Racing Association. And they ran it. I don't think it was any more than 1 year, maybe two. And there's just too much dissension. They couldn't agree on things. And of course, they were all competitive, racing against one another.
So they were also racers as well.
Yeah, it just died out.
Any of that remain in the area? What's become of the place?
I don't think there's any evidence at all. It's B&K Auto Salvage now, and it's just solid wrecked cars, old cars.
That's the one out here on the way to Union?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And that's where it was located?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. How about your, was that turned into a second job then, just about?
That's just about what it amounted to.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'd get up sometimes 5 o'clock in the morning, go out there and work, and then go to my business and work, and then go out there again in the evening and work. It was a full-time job to keep things going.
Mm-hmm.
We had a raised stand there where some of our JCs would be up there in that sand, and they were the timekeepers. Ran the race from up there.
So it was all JC labor.
Yeah.
From building things to operating.
Oh, I shouldn't say all that, because there was the volunteers that helped build it, and then like I say, this Joe Evers, he provided that water truck. Saw that it was out there watering the track whenever it needed it.
And all of this was done voluntarily.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a good effort on the part of the community. Well, I think we're about wrapped up here, but let's just do some brief talking about some of your other organizational work. We've talked about the Festival of Arts and the JCs. You talked about having been on the Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors.
Yeah, for quite a few years. I don't know how long. I never held any other office in the chamber.
What was their purpose? What did they do?
Promoting the town and the county. Basically the same as they are right now. Any promotional thing that they can.
Do you get invited to be on the Chamber of Commerce, or do they?
Oh, you get elected. Yeah.
But I mean, is that something that business owners would sort of be kind of expected to be involved in? It helps them out.
Yeah, it's Chamber of Commerce members that are elected to serve on the board.
And so you were a member of the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah.
Your business
yeah.
was a
yeah,
member.
For years.
Uh-huh. Any particular, they do anything special or memorable or?
Well, one of our top promoters in the area was David Baum, Sr. He was an attorney. And very active in the community. He also ended up as a general in the National Guard.
I believe he was the adjutant general of the state of Oregon at one time.
Yes, yes. And very good promoter of the area. He helped promote a lot of industrial development. very influential, I think, had a big hand in developing Industrial Park out where Terry Industries, Terry Trailer Plant out in that area. If I remember right, he was really a big promoter of that. And I'm not sure, but what he was also helped promote the industrial area out at the airport. But there was many things that he helped promote to the betterment of the county and city.
I also have you, Dan, as having served on the Red Cross Board.
Yeah, I spent, I don't know, one or two terms on the Red Cross Board.
Any particular activities or things that you were involved in during that?
Oh,
service?
Usually it was just fundraising mostly. Mm-hmm. And trying to accumulate more members that were interested.
Did you hold any office with the board, or were you just a member of the board?
No, I was just a board director. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of material here. I think that we're going to see that you've made a big contribution to knowledge about the area and history here in Union County.
Well, I hope that it's beneficial. Probably my most active, other than church, was the Grand Country Club.
What did you do with them?
I held office in there. I was one of the board of directors for a number of years, and then I was chairman of the Greens Committee, which was the operation of the course itself, and I served as vice president and became president. That was under David Baum, Sr. When he passed away, then I became president.
You mean you were vice president at the time of his death?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
Now, the Le Grand Country Club is a private organization?
Private organization,
It's a social golf?
Yeah.
What kinds of activities are they involved in?
Of course, everything, or a big part of it, is centered around golf itself. My wife and I were on a committee with about four or five other couples. We started Fairway Frolics, which is a man-wife tournament, and it's still in operation. This has been since 1971, and people come from various places. Walla Walla, Pendleton, all over the area playing in that.
So that's open to the public, that tournament?
Yeah. Any couple wants to get in.
How do you join the club? Is it by invitation?
No,
can
you
join on your own?
You just join on your own. You go out to see the pro, golf pro out there, and they'll give you an application form, and then that's presented to the board, and they decide whether you're eligible for membership or not.
Do you know what makes you eligible?
Well, of course, it's been a long time since I was on that board, but I imagine it's more or less the same way. They try to have a little background on your character. Know whether you have decent credit rating you're upstanding young, or upstanding resident.
Citizen.
But I did a lot of volunteer work out there on my own. When I had a sign company, I used to go out with my equipment, trim trees, and my wife and I worked and planted flowers. I built a flower bed and things of that nature. Then I laid brick pylons out on the front entrance and installed a sign, overhead sign over the entryway, things of that nature. I also designed the cart sheds, which they have expanded on considerably since I designed the first bunch of them, and they kept adding on.
What are some, that they have a golf course? Is there also a clubhouse or a restaurant bar? Or?
Yeah, they have a lounge, the bar, and then we just recently they did a complete overhaul on the social hall part of it, and just made a beautiful job out of it. And dining room and places to hold and hold dances, and so now they do have a lot of special like wedding parties, reception parties there, and for instance like a celebration for golden anniversaries and things of that nature. They rent the hall.
So the hall is open to the public. Is the lounge open to the public?
Not really.
Some members.
If you went to the club as a guest of a member, then of course you can have the lounge facilities and bar and all that. But for you to walk in off the street, no.
Is the golf course a public course?
No.
It's members only?
Members only. You can have in-county guests play golf there twice a year. But out of county, anybody can play by paying green fees.
At the golf course?
At the golf course.
Without a
member.
Without a member.
Yeah.
I see.
If you're from out of county.
Okay, so if you're in county, you don't have to be there with a member either, but you say you can...
If you live in county and want to play the course, you've got to do it with a member.
I see. And you can do that up to twice a year.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that to stimulate membership then?
Probably so. Mm-hmm. You know, every spring they have a membership drive when the initiation fee is cut away down half or less to get new members.
You and your wife have been a member of the club for a long time.
48 years.
Do you pay dues? Is there a life membership category there?
Well, that's something that supposedly working on now.
Oh, so they don't currently have one.
The bylaws state that after 50 years of continued membership, then you become a life member.
At which point, then you wouldn't pay dues because of that.
That's right.
Uh-huh. And they're working on this now, you say.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't know what the board will come up with on it. There's quite a bit of controversy.
Will the membership of the organization vote on that at some point?
Not likely.
It's decided by the board?
Board of directors.
So the board of directors make decisions that affect the entire club?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They run the organization. Mm-hmm. The club pro has been made manager also.
So would that be similar to being superintendent?
Well, manager of the club.
Oh, of the club.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's still supposedly under the board of directors. He can make certain decisions, but any big decision has to go through the board.
So similar to being an executive director to an organization.
Sort of, yeah. That'd be good explanation.
Then the halls where they do where they can do receptions or golden anniversary things, is that open to the public for rental?
Yes, it is.
I see. And that's one of the ways they make income then.
Yeah, there's income from that.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure what they charge for it now, but it's I really can't say.
And I imagine that, now, do you get reduced fees when you go to golf then by being a member?
Get what?
Do you get reduced fees to play as a member?
Oh, if you're a member, that takes care of all your golf.
I see.
Yeah, you can play as much as you want to, no extra charge.
Mm-hmm. How often do you golf these days?
I usually am out there 3 days a week.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. You that seem to be out there about every day.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a good junior program.
What's that about?
Wednesday is Women's Day.
What's a junior program?
Oh, the pro puts on a free school. Any youngsters that want to participate, whether they're members or not, they can come out. You have these free lessons to get them started.
Does the high school or the university use the course for their golf program?
Yes, they do. The high school, the college has been an on again, off again thing on having teams. Early 70s, they usually had a college team. In fact, my son, he got a golf scholarship when he got out of high school down in Texas. And in his junior year of college, they came to the Grand, and he went to school up here, Eastern Oregon, and was a member of their golf team. But in recent years, I don't think the high school, yes, they've got a team, but college, I don't think it does anymore.
And you said there's a Women's Day. What is that about?
Well, on Wednesday, the women have exclusive use of the golf course up until, I'm going to say, 2 o'clock. And come out and play. On Thursdays is Men's Day, and women are allowed to come out and play up till so that they will finish before